Today, I'd like to just thank Steve Fuchs and Kaufman for sponsoring this year, just for the sake of sponsoring. And thank you very much for that. Mitzvah Shem should be a good month for us all. What I'd like to do is the following. I was planning on a different topic this morning, but I think we're going to do that a little later, about the Arba Minim in action, Na'anuim. But instead, I'd like to focus upon a topic which is really fascinating. I had the opportunity of working with Rabbi David Foreman, with Emmanuel Shalev, in one of the Sukkos ideas, which is actually going to be released today on Aleph Beta. Which is for those of you who are subscribed, take a look for it. It's a very, very worthwhile Sukkos video which is being released today. And for those of you who are not subscribing, if you go to alephbeta.org, take a look at the Sukkos video. Very, very fascinating. So I'd like to just sort of give a little bit of background. Alephbeta.org. I'd like to just give a little bit of background to some of the ideas there. But just to give us a sense of some of the greater patterns that perhaps we miss. Here's the way, a particular way of thinking about it. You see, the Torah tells us about keeping the mitzvah or the chag of Sukkos. However, that's certainly not the first time that the Torah actually talks about Sukkos at all. There are two prior mentions of Sukkos in the Torah, and the two of them seem somewhat unrelated to what we're doing tonight. What we need to understand is, first of all, understand them on their own terms, and then reverse backwards into Sukkos and try to understand if they have some form of connection to Sukkos itself. So they are, the first time that Sukkos, of course, is mentioned in the Torah is
Yaakov does Sukkos.
That's right. So the first time happens to be in Parshas Vayishlach. In Parshas Vayishlach, what happens is Yaakov is just on his way back from the house of Lavan, and on his way back, after encountering Esav, and narrowly escaping Lavan, and encountering Esav, he then arrives at this place called Sukkos. This is what the pasuk tells us in source 1. V'Yaakov nasa Sukkosa. Yaakov travels to this place called Sukkos. V'yiven lo bayis, he makes himself a house. V'limigneu asa Sukkos. And for his cattle, for his livestock, he made Sukkos. Al ken kara shem makom Sukkos. And he therefore calls the name of the place Sukkos, which is a little strange, right? Because if you are on the naming committee of that place, what would you have called that place?
Bayis,
at the very least, right? Meaning it's strange. Like, he built two things. He built the house and he built the shed. And he calls the place shed, right? So it is a very strange reference over here. Number one, this is the first time we have the mention of this. It is interesting, of course, conceptually, that there are many Balei Machshava who attribute each of the Shalosh Regalim to one of the Avos. And of course, it goes, Pesach is Avraham, Shavuos is Yitzchak, and Sukkos, of course, is Yaakov. So, you know, this sort of lends itself, this is sort of like a textual grounding for that already, that Yaakov was associated with Sukkos in the beginning. Okay.
Not just bottom of Shabbat. The Torah is explicitly in the beginning of Hilchos Shvatim.
Correct, correct. So
the months are connected to Shvatim.
Correct. So the Torah, wearing his Baal HaTurim hat, sometimes in the Torah itself, also makes us note, as Dr. Yago well points out. So now,
it makes the point that what?
That the regalim are connected to the three Avos. And this one is what works out over here, interestingly enough. Anyway, so this doesn't seem to have anything to do with our Sukkos whatsoever on a face value. But the interesting thing is that when we get to a little later, there happens to be a second mention of Sukkos. This one's a lesser known one. As the nation of Israel are leaving Egypt, we're told, this is in Perek Yud Beis. Now, Perek Yud Beis in Shmos is the description of that Nisan should be the Rosh Chodashim, and it talks about all the mitzvahs about Pesach, and at the very end of that Perek in Yud Beis, in Perek Yud Beis Lamed Zayin, this is what we read in Parashas HaChodesh. We are told that Israel now leaves. Vayisu b'nei Yisrael miRamses, so they leave Ramses. This is their first escape from Egypt. Sukkosa, to a place called Sukkos. V'keshesh me'os elef ragli ha'gvarim levad mitaf. 600,000 count of men, excluding the children. So now, what you have over here is another arrival at, and of course this doesn't seem to be a functional Sukkos, it seems to be just a place called Sukkos, which seems to be our next arrival. So we have these two, you know, really seemingly disconnected mentions of a place called Sukkos. First question you should ask yourself, is it the same place? And the answer should be?
No.
Definitely not, because we're in different peninsulas right here, meaning this is somewhere in we'll call it the southeast area of Sinai, at best.
Africa
most likely. Right, so we're talking about really, we were talking about Egypt border over here, whereas the Sukkos of Yaakov was when he was traveling from Syria area downwards to Israel. So they're really clearly not the same Sukkos whatsoever. So you say to yourself, well, notice that maybe that's just what happens, it's one of those common names. It was like Springfield, and, every state's got its Springfield, right? So what? Maybe there's no significance to it. But if you think a little bit more, before we even get to Sukkos, it actually happens to be that these two are very, very much connected. There's a lot, even though they may be places, they're in different suburbs, they are very much connected. How so? Let's think about this for a second. Okay, so there's textual connections and there's conceptual connections. Let's start maybe perhaps with conceptual connections and then see if the conceptual connections lend themselves to textual connections. Okay? Meaning, is there anything to talk about here in the first place? Okay? So it happens to be that we're talking about Yaakov, who's now leaving the house of Lavan, ascending back to Israel. Right? So instead of Yaakov now moving from his, we'll call it his refuge or his exile, we now have Israel, the national scale, leaving their refuge / exile back to or journeying towards the Israel as well, from a different direction. Okay, interesting. Interesting. So it happens to be it's sort of like the exit path in both directions seems to be starting with a Sukkot stop. That's what it sounds like in both cases. Fascinating. But let's go a little further. It happens to be that the transformation of Yaakov from an individual to a tribe happens in this place. Meaning Yaakov enters a single man and exits with wives and children, Shvatim. Israel enters as tribes and children and exits as a nation, right? So there seems to be these two places that they exit which lead to Sukkos is almost the breeding ground for the next stage of development of this enterprise, right? Moreover, in both the places, it seems to be that there is an economic use of or misuse of the protagonist. So, Yaakov Avinu is working for Lavan. He works endless hours. He works unpaid for most of the time. And if it wasn't for Hashem at the very end, sort of making it all work out, he would have been misused. It would have been slave labor. And that's exactly what was happening in Egypt. If it weren't for Hashem interceding at the very end, then they were simply economic foundations for the Egyptian culture and the Egyptian economy, which is part of the reason why the Egyptians were so reticent to let them go, was because of look how much they're contributing to us, right? The same sort of general pattern of these two, perhaps on a personal level and then on a national scale.
But technically, Yaakov, that departure in Source 1 is really from Esav already. Mm. So sort of leaving a
correct. So there
of
isn't
danger.
Correct. So as you're pointing out, there's an extra point is that the Sukkos of Yaakov happens not only after he leaves Lavan, but also the encounter of Esav, which is something we need to factor in as to there's two aspects of escape there which are occurring. Okay. So if this is true, you'd say to yourselves, well, I'd hope that perhaps the Torah would make this a little more clearer to us, that we wouldn't have to start philosophizing and theorizing. So the answer is, well, the Torah does make it pretty clear. Because let's take a look at a few examples. Yeah, let's take a look at assurance. So when Yaakov Avinu is about to leave the house of Lavan, on the bottom page 1, it says, Vayomer Hashem el Yaakov, Shuv el eretz avosecho l'maratetecho, v'ei yeimach. God says to Yaakov, don't worry, I'm going to be with you. Is that funny? That's the same words, that's the same description of Hashem describing himself when he tells Moshe at the burning bush, that I'm going to send you to Israel to leave because right? That's the name that Hashem says to Moshe Rabbeinu as being the accompanying expression of himself when it comes to Yetzias Mitzrayim as well, in the assurance. In terms of the fleeing, let's take a quick look at this. In the next section, when it comes to Lavan chasing after Yaakov, it says, Vayugad l'Lavan b'yom ha-shlishi kivorach Yaakov. Lavan was told on the third day. Remember, Lavan's out on a shearing trip, right? He's out with his sons elsewhere, and that's when Yaakov takes the break. So it was told to Lavan, he receives the message from one of his scouts or somebody who noticed that they left. Happens to be the only other place in the Torah that the words Vayugad la ever appears in the Torah is Vayugad la Melech Mitzrayim ki varacha om. Same formulation.
Didn't add an another parallel, a few psukim before that.
Yes.
It says it was after the third day. Mm-hmm. Then it became Vayugar.
Correct. So it happens to be exactly. Also happens to be in terms of the time frame. Now, the time frame isn't as explicit in Parshas Beshalach, where it describes this. But it happens to be that we're going to see that the time frame of Egypt is also going to be a seven-day time frame. Same with Lavan. Lavan is explicitly a seven-day period, and same with Mitzrayim, a little less explicit, is where you see that it's going to be a third-day notification, seven-day catch-up, which is why, of course, the seventh day of Pesach is where Kriyas Yamsuf occurs. That's when the Egyptians catch up with the fleeing people. It's the same exact format as Lavan catching up with Yaakov, right? Moreover, listen to the verbs of the pursuit for a second. In the case of Lavan, Vayikach esechav imoy vayirdov acharov derech shivas yomim vayedbeko sa bahara gidlad. So we have this, he takes his close brothers, his helpers, and he chases after him. Similarly, in the case of Beshalach, when it talks about the pursuing Bnei Yisrael, Vayikach sheish mos rechav bachur v'chol rechem Yisrael v'shol yishim al kuloi. The verb is taking. Vayichazek Hashem es lei paroi melech Mitzrayim. God strengthened his heart. Vayirdof acharei Bnei Yisrael. Bnei Yisrael yosim v'yad ramah. The same two verbs describing the action taken in reference to Israel of Vayikach vayirdof. And similarly, catching up with them is Vayaseg Lavan es Yaakov. Yavan catches Yaakov. The same idea is, of course, Vayirdofu Mitzrayim achareim. Vayasigu oisam chonim alayam. Same description of verbs. Meaning, the operative verbs in description between, we'll call it, our pursuer and our victim, are going to be exactly the same. Vayikach, Vayirdof, Vayasig. Those are the three verbs describing their relationship to each other. And of course, they are paralleled in both the national and in the individual crisis that's being experienced over here. And also, of course, it just happens to be, very interestingly enough, in the empty-handed aspect of it, it is interesting that when Yaakov defends himself, he says the following. He says, Lulei Elokei Avi Elokei Avram Bopachad Yitzhak Hayali Ki Ato Rekom Shelachtani. So he says to Lavan, you would have left me on the side of the street, meaning you would have just driven off. You know, if it had been up to you, I would have been completely empty-handed if it weren't for the fact that God interceded. That's exactly what Hashem says by Bnei Yisrael in the vision of the burning bush, early on in Shmos Perikimel, V'nosati yascheina oma ze b'nei Mitzrayim, v'ayu ki selchon lo yiselchu rekom. God says, I'm going to make sure you're not going to leave empty-handed. Like Yaakov Avinu is saying to Lavan, if it was up to you, I would have been empty-handed. Right? So it does seem to be that there are more, but this is like on the base level. It seems to be that whatever Yaakov Avinu is doing here is almost the microcosm of what's going to happen later on a national scale, right? And so therefore, it shouldn't be surprising to us that the stop which the Torah identifies in both those exits in opposite directions towards Israel are, of course, the super stop, which is interesting, right? So now let's try to unpack that a little bit. Okay, so now, you know, when you have a little bit of a structure, so the question is, what do you do with a structure? Meaning, okay, that's interesting, so we can nod about it and think about it and tell it over our tables, but what do you make of that? So a theory that Rabbi Soloveitchik has, and Rabbi Foreman expands upon, which I think is really remarkable, is the following. Is if you think about it over here, what was it? What was the turning point in Yaakov Avinu's sojourn in Lavan's house, which woke him up to the fact that he should be leaving? Meaning, at which point, if we try to understand what's going on in the parallel to Egypt, what was it about Yaakov that helped him out? Okay, so later on there was a revelation. I mean, first of all, he saw that the face of Lavan wasn't the same as before, and then the revelation, right? That was a little later already. There was another, the psukim describe something that happened that Yaakov Avinu realized was time to start moving. The birth of Yosef, right? So the psukim said that explicitly. Take a look in the next source. The psukim say in Bereshis Lamed Chafei Vayhi Kasher Yolda Rachel Yosef Vayomer Yaakov Lavan Shlacheni Ve'elchol Mokomi Ol Artzi. So that sort of catalyzed the beginning of the end. Yaakov now says it's time for me to start going. Okay, this is when all the negotiations start. So
actually, when he left, he lived another 6 years.
Yes, correct. But the point is that the negotiations start for leaving now, right? Yaakov, in his mind, this is already now. The beginning of the end has happened. Now, later on, we're going to have the vision. We're going to have the consultation with his wives. All things that's going to happen. Why, in Yaakov's mind, should Yosef be his ticket out? Meaning, why does this become the beginning of the end for him? Okay, so Rashi quotes a Medrash that he says, "Vaya beis Yaakov lakash." Right. So there's a whole description in, if I'm not mistaken, in Ovadia, where it talks about how there's this parallel of the house of Esav is going to be of straw, and the house of Yaakov is the fire, and the little flame that connects the two is Yosef. Yosef somehow is the undermining agent of Esav, and he felt ready to confront Esav when Yosef was born.
The antidote for
Esav, which is very fascinating. It doesn't explain why. Right? That message doesn't explain why. Eddie?
Rabbi Foreman says that Yaakov, heard that Vador of Yeshua came up, and then he was the fourth generation.
Good, exactly. So another way to go about this is to say the following. Let's say from the perspective of Yaakov Avinu. He knows about the Bris Ben Abisarim, and he knows that Avram is told that your generations are going to go into some form of galus in Eretz Lo Elohem, Vavadon V'inu Oisam. They're going to have this, they're going to be subjugated to unfair labor, and they're going to be in a foreign language, base. And what's going to happen is you're going to experience this, you and your children, until Dor Revi Yashuv Ohena. Now, it's interesting because he did describe a time frame there, right? In the end of the day, it was 400 years that was described. Now, this is certainly not 400 years yet. At the same time, we should also remember that in Egypt, there wasn't 400 years either. Right, there was 210, which is interesting because how many years was Yaakov in the house of Lavan? 21/22, which is interesting, which is almost like the 10% of that experience, right, on a microcosm level. Now, if this is true, that means to say that Yaakov over here is thinking back. Now, we at the end of the story say to ourselves, oh, well, of course, Yaakov's leaving at this time, and this is everything's going to work out, and it all worked out, and it was fine. But in the end of the day, as Yaakov is experiencing, what is Yaakov thinking? What is he thinking? So he sees, look, I got this prophecy. There's this terrible experience which is going to befall the children of Yaakov, of Abraham. But Dor Revi Yashuv Ohena. So who's the Dor Revi? So if it's Abraham is one, Yitzhak is two, Yaakov is three. So it should be Yaakov's generation should be number four, his children. Happens to be, who did Yaakov want to marry? Who did Yaakov think he should marry? Rachel. Who was he tricked into marrying was? Right. Leah. So in a certain sense, when was the first child born of the Dor Revi of who he thought was intended to be his partner was? Yosef from Rachel. This is the first time that there is the Dor Revi over here. So he says, wait a second, now maybe is the time, now maybe we can exit this galus. Maybe the Bris Ben Abisarim was expressing itself on whom? Rachel. On me. And maybe this is the way out. So now Yaakov starts his preparations. He starts exiting. And the Torah tells us that yes, somehow what was happening to Yaakov was in fact close enough later on to be the Yetzias Mitzrayim, to be the expression of the real Bris Ben Abisarim. Something was there, but in the end of the day, something went wrong. Something we don't know. Something must have gone wrong. It wasn't the full expression of the Bris Ben Abisarim. It might have been the Maaseh Avos. Might have been the progenitor of the later real Bris Ben Abisarim. But he himself, as experiencing it, it could be that Yaakov Avinu was experiencing exactly that. Which is why it gives you such an unbelievable insight into the following. What does it mean after this whole thing is said and done? Yaakov Avinu now comes out, and he goes and he settles down. What does the pasuk say? Vayeshev Yaakov be'eretz megurei aviv. And what does Rashi say? Be'kesh Yaakov leishev be'shalva. Yaakov wanted to sit in shalva, in tranquility. Why? Because think about it.
This is the fundamental difference between Yosef and the Shvatim. Whether are they there for good, or are they going back to go? This is just round one.
Exactly. Exactly that. Now you see what's happening over here. Yaakov says, I'm done. I'm finished. We've done the Bris Ben Abisarim. We're done. Thank goodness. Baruch Hashem. What happens? Ella told us, Yaakov, Yosef. Who was the reason that he thought that he was his exit card from Golos was? Yosef. Says Rashi, Kofat Zolov, Ruchzul Shul Yosef. The very exit ticket became the machinations of round number two. That's the Vayeshev Yaakov is in a certain sense the hinge of Golos 1 entering into Golos 2. The microcosm into the macrocosm. And that's what's happening. It gives you so much more of a perspective of the tragedy of what Yaakov goes through in terms of Yosef over here. Yosef now is not the exit. Yosef is the entry into this. What was that?
Why does he ask love for permission? Maybe he thought, I'm bound. And that was the whole, what you're saying is he felt he was like somewhere that was
interesting.
Otherwise,
we
asked for Paro as well. We wanted Paro too, right? But there was this Hashem's, there was a Paro's involvement and then Hashem's involvement in Paro as well, which sort of prevented that happening. But that does parallel in a certain sense. And of course, that's what the Haggadah is saying. Arami Oved Avi, meaning in the Haggadah's interpretation of Arami Oved Avi, that is Lavoim and Paro, of course, that's exactly what the Haggadah is trying to tell us. Meaning, when we need to understand the Haggadah, we don't start with the Haggadah, we go back to Yaakov and Lavoim, because of course, that's where it started. Okay, so now that at this point, what does that have to do with Sukkos? So now, this is what we're trying to do, is trying to do Sukkos, not so much Bereishis here, so let's go backwards now. So now, what was that? It's all tied together, but let's try to appreciate how. Okay, so now, if it's true that in these two parallel episodes you have the Sukkos as being almost like our doorway, our door frame out of the personal or national goddess, so then, now we come back to Sukkos. So, we come back to Sukkos and we need to ask a few basic questions. And very simple questions, which should be the following. In the way that Rav Forman frames it, I think it's a very, very beautiful way of framing it is the following. Is if we ask ourselves the question, big deal or little deal, right? So if we say to ourselves, let's take a look at the three regalim, right? And ask ourselves, you know, big deal, little deal, you know, how big a deal is it? Pesach. Pesach represents what event? Exodus, right? So big deal, little deal, answer is? Big deal, right? We would still be Egyptian speaking, you know, subclass of society, along with the Coptic Christians. We'd not be doing so well with ISIS on the borders. That's a pretty, pretty big deal, right? Comes to Shavuos, big deal, little deal. What does Shavuos represent? What event was it? Sinai. What was the import of Sinai? It was the fact that God decided to relate to humanity as a whole. I mean, God came down out of the heavens, came down onto human territory, and boom! Hashem said, I'm going to interact with you. I'll care enough about you to actually give you something to do in the world. Right? That was the whole of creation was waiting for that Yom HaShishi. Everything was waiting for this moment. That's, you know, without the Torah, we would simply be a nomadic tribe in the Sinai Peninsula, trying to steal oil from somebody else. You know, like, we'd be stuck, you know, in as a free but not free nation. We wouldn't have a mission from in terms of life. So what do we do? So that's a pretty big deal. Sukkos! What does Sukkos represent? What event is Sukkos represent? So you say, we had these huts, and these huts were, you know, very helpful. They were definitely protected us. But you know, like in terms of like the deal, you know, like how big a deal that is, it's like, you know, Exodus, Sinai and the huts. You know, it's like, you know, really sort of just sort of, you know, the music trails off, and you're not really feeling it there. So you say, no, look, that's not really a fair way of presenting it, right? That's a little bit of a propaganda way of presenting it, because in the end of the day, the Gemara tells us that it wasn't only huts, right? So the Gemara tells us there's a machlokas about this, right? The Gemara tells us, if you take a look in source 7. The Gemara is on Sukkah Yud Aleph. Ki besukkos hashavti b'nei Yisrael, the machlokas. Ki besukkos hashavti b'nei Yisrael, ananei hakavod hayu. Divrei Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Kiva Omer, sukkos mamashoy osu lohem. So Rabbi Kiva says it's true that it was huts, but Rabbi Eliezer seems to be a little more grand about it. He says it was ananei hakavod. Now, if you ask yourselves, is ananei hakavod important? The answer is, of course. Without ananei hakavod, we were in a desert. There are lots of bad things in a desert. We could have been killed by any number of enemies, or wild animals, you know, heat. There's the exposure. There's so many things that we could have been exposed to. That's a pretty big deal. The problem is, if Timtzi Loimar, right? If you're going to say, okay, you know what? It was the Ananei HaKavod. That was a really big deal. But at the end of the day, do we have a festival celebrating the day we got the water? Celebrating the day that the manna came? We don't, right? And those are equally as important on Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So those come sort of, you know, those are basic foundational requirements, right? We don't, and Sukkot isn't sort of like, you know, just like a, you know, national July 4th barbecue day. It's, I mean, this is a serious holiday. Think how long we've been preparing for this. 7 days, take the whole family out into the hut, the whole business. It's not so simple. And, right, it's obviously very important, right? But if it's so important, then why are the clouds more important than the food and the water, right? So there's something strange about it. Even more than that, if you want to kind of come back to this chazal is strange also because, like, you know, it's like, you know, Pesach, we're pretty clear about what happened. You know, Shavuos, we're pretty clear about what happened. Sukkos is sort of, well, there's a machlokes as to what happened, and that's why we celebrate it. It's like, Hatz, clouds, that's a little strange paradigm of a holiday. We're still debating what the holiday's about. You know, July 4th, you know, it happens to be somebody's birthday or Independence Day. It's not. We know what happens, right? So on Sukkot, it is very strange. So perhaps the way of looking at this is the following. If you're to pull out a calendar of the year, let's say 2448, right? And you were to now pull out your Sharpie and to try to like mark the date of the holidays. This might be our way in. So let's say you needed to identify which day on the calendar the Pesach occurred, the event of Pesach. So the event of Pesach would of course be what date? The 15th of Nisan. So you'll be able to pull out your red Sharpie, you know, make a nice X on that date, and we'll put it on our Google calendar reminder on an annual basis. Left Egypt. Correct? Okay, good. So then it kind of comes down to Shavuos. Where do we put the Sharpie? A little more complex. But it's 50 days later, right? So according to most opinions, we talk about the 6th of Sivan, so we put a nice little X there. We can put like a little asterisk saying that there's another opinion that it was the 7th. Okay, but nonetheless, we have a date. And now you pull out your Sharpie and you say, okay, where's Sukkot going to go? Sort of where can I put the X? And the answer is, well, yeah, no, it's going to be like you block out, you know, 40 years. It's like sort of busy, you know, like do not disturb, right? So, it's a little different, right? It doesn't work out as well. So what's going on over here? Unless maybe there was a discrete event. Maybe Sukkot, in fact, wasn't just a 40-year background event. Maybe it was a discrete event. So come back to our original ideas. Let's take a look at what the Torah tells us about this. Take a look at the very top of page 3 for a second. The Torah tells us why we sit in Sukkos. Okay, so it says Chof Gimel Mem Beis in Parshas Emor. Basukkos Teishu Shivas Yamim Kol Ezrach B'Yisrael Yashuv Sukkos. You should dwell in Sukkos 7 days. All citizens of Israel will dwell in Sukkos. Leman yedu doroseichem. You should know why. Ki besukkos hashavti es bnei Yisrael, because I made Israel dwell in Sukkos. Boitzi osam eretz Mitzrayim, as I took them out of Egypt. Now, if you were writing the Torah, what was the time frame of Sukkos you would give? Right. So you might say b'nissan, but if the focus of it is a miracle which transpired for the desert journey, what would Hashem be telling us? Hashem is saying, because Sukkos Shati Bamidbar. Right? I would have said, I'll let you stay in Sukkos in the desert experience, if that's the way to understand it. But the Torah doesn't say that. The Torah almost sort of like puts it into the shadow of Egypt, into Exodus, which is like a little confusing, because after all, if you want to give Sukkos its own identity, you know, then give it its own identity. Put it in the desert, which they weren't, you know. But no, it's sliding it into Exodus. So you have to ask yourselves, so was there a Sukkos that Hashem was Moshe b'nei Yisrael when they left Egypt? And the answer is yes, because we just saw it. We just saw it, actually. When we come back to Shmos Yud-Beis Lamed Zayin, which we just described beforehand, the first stop Israel experienced as they left Egypt, the first stopping place, the first night after leaving was Yisrael b'nei Yisrael me'ram says Sukkos. They went to Sukkos. So doesn't that, you know, you say to yourself, well, that's a very strange coincidence that the Torah is telling us that I'm making you stay in Sukkos because the Sukkos are shattered today, but it's here somewhere in Sushraim. The time they left Egypt, I made them dwell in Sukkos, and then we find a Sukkos as being the first stop. Strange, right? Mm. Now, this is a little bit strange because here's the reason why we never suggest this. Because, first of all, it seems like Chazal don't do this, right? Chazal don't seem to be interested in this parallel, if we're reading this right. Number two is that this is sort of, it moves away from everything we've known, meaning this is not the desert experience. This is sort of coming back all the way to Pesach, which is very different, right? This is a discrete event, but what would be so important about that event that needs, that necessitates this, right? So there seems to be this parallel, but the question is, like, that doesn't sit right. So what do we do with that? Okay, so let's think a little bit about this here for a second. So, here's the way to look at this. Perhaps let's read the psukim, what happened on that night, and it'll take it from there. Yes.
Is there a this the same sukkahs that Yaakov went to?
No. No, it isn't. But we'll see in a second.
Before they got to the Yamsu, they were at children. They had that protection from because the Egyptians were going to come after them. So they needed that Anana Kodesh at that point.
Correct. So, Dr. Hahnemann, you're pointing out is that perhaps this is the most necessary point to need that Anakov, but it sort of diminishes from it being a desert experience and more of a specific night. We have to ask ourselves what was special about that night.
But the date is off also. It should have been the 16th of Nisan.
Oh, okay, good. Interesting. Okay, good. Well, let's come back for a second to that. I want to come back to that point in a moment. So let's look at source 8 for a moment. This is what's told to us about that night. So Yisrael ibn Yisrael Meiram says, "Sukosa kashesh mos elef ragli hayvorim levad mitav." So we told 600,000 of these Israelites leave Egypt, go to from Ramses to Sukkos that night. Vagam erev rav olayim itam the son of Akor mikne kaved ma'or. They have a lot of cattle. That's important because remember Yaakov Avinu when he's leaving the house of Lavan, of course, also has a lot of cattle. And the Torah emphasizes that. So what's the first activity they do in this place called Sukkos? Is they eat matzah, right? Because they don't have any food. Why? What was that?
They baked it.
All they had was dough, and that they simply had no food. They dwelled in Mitzrayim for 430 years. Again, another focus on the time frame. After the 430 years, then on this day, Yotzu called Tzivos B'nei Yisrael Me'emetz Yisrael, they left Egypt. That's the pasuk of Exodus, if you had to point to any. V'leil Shimurimu LaHashem, it's the night of guarding from Hashem, Lo'etzio Me'emetz Mitzrayim, Hu Alayla Azeh LaHashem Shimurim L'Kol B'nei Yisrael L'Dor HaSam. It is the day where Hashem guarded all of Israel for the generations. So this is what we're being told over here. Now, interestingly enough, there's a lot of things we can think about. What for me, the way I can sort of imagine this is I remember once going camping in the Catskills. We had a three-day camping trip with me and a couple of friends, and we got eaten completely alive by the mosquitoes on the way up, even though we sprayed the clothes. And we went to the top of the mountain. We fought to get to the top of the first mountain by nightfall. We just made it as the sun had set, and we sort of set up our tent on the top of the mountain. No cell phone signal, no connection to humankind. We have to hoist our food up, so the bears don't get it. We lost our way back to the tent, and now one of these great adventures. And I remember trying to go to sleep that night and looking through the very thin netting that separates us between us and the forest and the sky above us. And it's not very quiet on mountaintops in outdoors. You hear every rustle, everything moving around, or it's very much alive out there. Mm-hmm. And I remember the feeling of terror because it is bear country and every movement out there, and there's lots of movement out there, sounds very much like something coming closer to the tent. And to top it off as well, our gas cooker, tested everything except the gas cooker, which didn't work. So we're carrying all this rice and pasta, which we couldn't eat. And so we're eating living off rice cakes and snack bars. And I remember going to sleep hungry and terrified, and so basically falling asleep every hour, saying to as many Tehillim as I could possibly do, and waking up in the morning feeling absolutely terrible. And that was kind of like my first night on the camping trip. And if you think about it, you sort of put yourselves back in the space of Israel, what's going through their mind then. You have to think about it. They had a place. As much as they were slaves, they also had what the Torah calls a moshav. Moshav b'nei Yisrael b'Mitzrayim. They had a place where they dwelled. And what was this moshav? When you're a slave, when you have a place, in a certain sense, it offers you two things. It offers you food and shelter, meaning, as much as they were slaves, the next day they still knew where breakfast was coming from. They still knew at the end of the day that there's a roof over their heads. The moment they leave, what's happening over here? Their moshav has disappeared, right? Moshav ben Israel, they had 430 years of knowing where the next meal comes from and knowing that there's a roof over their heads. The first night, you see what the Torah is doing? The Torah is contrasting that first night to 430 years of expectancy. Now they move outwards, and what's left? Nothing. They don't have any food. Right, remember this jump into the unknown. They don't have any food. They don't have any shelter. So what do? They go to this place Sukkos. Why is it called Sukkos? What does the Torah tell us about the place Sukkos? Why did Yaakov call it Sukkos? Because he built the sheds. Meaning he lived in the house, but the cattle were in the sheds. This place over here is called sheds because clearly there weren't any houses. Clearly the place they arrived at was either they built or they found sheds for their cattle. Where were they sleeping? They're probably sleeping either under the stars or with their cattle in the sheds. Right, think about this. They lived in there, wherever it was, probably very low-class tenement buildings in Mitzrayim. But now they're with their cattle. Now they're under the stars. Now they're in these sheds the first night. Now they're eating. Instead of eating where their meals come from, they've got this dough which hasn't even had a chance to rise. The experience of the night is one of terror. After the exhilaration and the headiness of everything else that we're free, think about, you know, the kids are like, Mommy, Daddy, where are we going to sleep? You know, and then the teenagers say, we're hungry. What's going to happen now? The reality sets in. What happens this first night is the first night of the jump into the unknown. This night was the moment where Israel became a nation in a certain sense because they jumped into God's hands. This is what Yirmiyahu says, by the way. Yirmiyahu says, we quoted it on the Haftorah, on Rosh Hashanah in Source 9. Holoch v'koros v'ozne Yerushalayim ne'mor. Koyamar Hashem, Zacharti lach chesed nu'urayich, avas klulosayich lechtech acharay b'amibar be'eretz lo zeruah. You went after me. You jumped after me. That was the most unbelievable jump of faith, says Yirmiyahu, that you moved away from food and shelter. And now, this is the first night where both now came into dire need. Now, if you think about this for a second, this night is a watershed event, this first night in Sukkot. This is where it's all happening over here. But the problem is that if what we're saying is true, then it becomes a little strange, because that means to say that we're celebrating Sukkot and Pesach essentially for the same reason then, right? Meaning, if we're thinking about it, let's come back for a second, actually. Maybe we'll start this way. Let's go back to the Machloikas of Chazal, where is Sukkot Mamish or Ananei HaKavod. Think about that first night. So they're sleeping under the stars. One quick second. So they're sleeping under the stars. And look, they're either in their cattle sheds or next to their cattle sheds with their numerous cattle. Nowhere really to sleep. No food to be had. And they're looking up. And it's at that moment that they make the realization that, in fact, they're not just under the stars. That they realize that, in fact, they're within the embrace of the divine. They're in the protection of Hashem. It's not just in the huts. The two deos in the Gemara about whether it's Sukkot Mamish or Ananei HaKavod is exactly the experience they're having. All we have is these huts for our cattle, the first moment where there's nothing else. We had to just construct this, you know, we'll put a little piece of fronds over here and this board over here. That's all they could do. But then they realize that actually we're not just looking through boards, we're looking into Hashem's clouds. The focus of the machlokes of Ananei HaKavod or Sukkot Mamish is exactly the question of whose side of the story are you on? Was it them making it, or was Hashem responding to their making it on that first night, and which continued to be the precedent for the rest of the desert? That's the two days over here. How they put it through? Yes.
Either way, the word
Shabbat
doesn't make sense.
Oh, so now let's think about this for a second. The Torah clearly is referencing this, because when the Torah says Kibusukos Shabbat, that's the same word that was used on Moshe Bnei Yisrael Beretz Mitzrayim, which means to say the following: what Hashem is saying like this. You folks, you know where you were, you know who you depended on, you know what was your place of comfort was, Moshe ben Israel, Eretz Mitzrayim, for 430 years, your Moshav, your place of dependence, where you could rest your head and know your breakfast was Mitzrayim. Ki b'sukkos hashavti b'nei Israel. What was the transition of Sukkos? Is the movement from Egypt being the Moshav to me. That's the point over here. I'm the Moshav now. Now when you go out, where's your food coming from? Where's your shelter coming from? That's what's happening over here. The transition point over here. Now, the problem is if this is true, and by the way, what Chazal is saying when they have the machlokes about what's Ananei HaKavod and Sukkot Mamish, that's exactly what they're saying. Meaning, you think they ignore this parallel? No, this became the beginning. This is the first step into the desert experience. Their machlokes is exactly the two sides of whether we're doing it and Hashem's responding. They weren't ignoring that. They're explaining it. How do you think they knew that it was Sukkot Mamish? Because Yaakov, and it's all over here. Now let's take it further. If this is true, the problem is the following. If Sukkot, as the Torah seems to describe, is because of that initial step as we left Egypt, then the problem is that Sukkot is the furthest time from the time it happened, right? If you think about it, it's like very unusual. Meaning, I understand on the night of Pesach, and Dr. Wake's point well taken, on the night of Pesach, or even more potentially the second night of Pesach, which is when we're eating this matzah over here, I understand we're recreating that scene, that moment where we had nothing. So we're sort of scrapping together like the little bits and, you know, half-baked bread, and we're experiencing that moment of dependency. But like, you know, like, why is it now that 6 months later we're suddenly going out into our sukkahs? We should do, we should have a mega festival. You can imagine what this would look like. You know, you eat matzah in your sukkah in Nissan. You can imagine the prices of things. You know, you'd be like matzahs and sukkahs all on central on the sidewalks. It's unbelievable. What you could do is at least you could budget for it all at once. You know, we'd have a mega festival, which would be all about Exodus, right? You can imagine that it'd be a killing. But in the end of the day, it isn't that way. It's almost like what the Torah did was the Torah said, took that night and almost sort of split that night up and moved one part to the recognition of that night to the furthest time possibly away from it, right? Meaning, Sukkot is exactly 6 months in either direction from Pesach, right? The 15th of Nisan, the 15th of Tishrei, is the furthest possible way in either direction of time. Because in a certain sense, what the Torah is doing is it's breaking up and saying, that moment where you jumped into the unknown is so important that I need to educate it to you at the time that it happened and at the time that you're furthest from remembering that it happened. Both chronologically, but also ideologically. Think about it for a moment. If you take the snapshot of this poor, homeless, you know, ragtag bunch of slaves who have now sort of just made it into the Sinai Peninsula, who are sleeping in cattle sheds without any food, contrast that with the picture of the nation of Israel living in the land of Israel, who now have homes, have granaries, are coming in from the fields, and they're going now to hang up their sickles, and they're going to now fill up they've just filled up their grain houses. That's a picture of confidence. That's a picture of success. That's a picture of having made it. So the Torah says, at this point in time, that's when you walk out again. You walk past your Ramses, you walk past your grain houses, and you now go, and you sit in the sukkah, and you recreate it. Not when it happened, but when you need it to happen. And by the way, how do you know this is true? Very simply, this is what Chazal was saying. When Chazal of Machlekes in the Gemara Sukkah on Chav Zayinam Aleph, the Gemara says that that there's a Machlekes as to the Rabbi Elezna Chacham about whether you need to be in your own Sukkah or not. The Gemara opens up what's called a Gzera Shava. There's a Gzera Shava called Tezvav Tezvav, which is that the Psukim describe the night of Pesach and the night of Sukkot with the same words. It's on the 15th night of the month of Tishrei, the 15th night of the month of Nisan. And the Gemara creates, we'll call it a conceptual bridge between the two holidays, which allows us to learn certain halachas one way and the other way. Where one of the halachas we learn, which is going to be effective tonight, is that you need to eat, not this month, but the kazai is the kibbutz actually, that you need to eat in the sukkah on the first night. Meaning, during the rest of the nights of sukkahs, if you decide not to eat, right, then technically speaking, you know, you eat snacks, you wouldn't technically have to be in the sukkah. But the first night, you have to eat in the sukkah. Why? The Torah never told us we have to be in the sukkah the first night. But the Gzera Shuvah tells us that because on the first night of Pesach, there's a chiyuv to eat matzah and a certain shear of matzah. So therefore, that parallels over to sukkahs that we eat in the same way. Isn't that fascinating? Mm-hmm. It's almost like, see what's happening here in Chazal? The eating on the night, the first night, it's the same experience which is occurring, which was that first night experience reflected, whether it be in terms of what we're eating or where we're eating it, split up by the Tesvav across the time frame of the year. That's what's going on. Well, this is what Chazal is saying. Also, the other aspect of the Gezerah Shavah is that it's called Ezrach BeYisrael, that it has to be any Jew is allowed to be there because it's the equalizer. Right? When we were out there, there was nobody in their noble shacks and other people in their lesser shacks. They were all sleeping in their cattle sheds. There was that's exactly what was going on that night. And just to close, perhaps, one extra, very fascinating thought. And that is that if we think about that very clearly, this explains the last pasuk, which was in the Egypt description, which is in Perek Yud Beis pasuk Mem Beis. This is a night of guarding. Leil Shimurim Hu La Hashem Leatzia Meretz Mitzrayim Hu Alayla Azel La Hashem Shimurim Lachol Bnei Yisrael Adarasam. It's the night of guarding where Hashem guarded. It's the night of guarding of Israel, because you have to remember that there's two components. There's the component of Israel doing, making their sheds. And then there's a component of Hashem responding with the Ananei HaKavod. And there's these two elements which seem to be fundamental to the whole process, which is our investment, and then Hashem's response to our investment. The Sukkos Mamish, the Ananei HaKavod, which seems to be occurring all at once at this moment, which is what we're doing. So we're a part of the educational process over here, right now, of the Tanatim Es Hashem, the educational process of remembering what it means to jump into the unknown even though we're very much in the known, even though right now we live in wonderful, Baruch Hashem, we blessed circumstances, with the style of living we live today, is the average person lives in a more comfortable domicile than kings of previous generations. We think about it. Heating, water, all the different things that we have at our disposal. But the Torah says to us, wait a second, let's go backwards. Let's remember what that jump into the unknown was, because when you make the jump, I'm there to catch you as well. Mitzvah Hashem should be a wonderful Zman Simcha Senu for all of us.